216 Los Angeles, California 90042. Come through, family. Let's gather, sing, sway, and hold space together for the music, the memories, the long, strange trip, and for Bobby, whose spirit lives in every note we share.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage.
Clausens are a middle-class family in a small college town, Bloomington, Indiana. Their neighborhood streets wind through soft hills dotted with two-story houses. When we arrived, the family greeted me and my co-producer Emily at the door with smiles. Beth, the matriarch, has kind eyes and short gray hair. Her husband, Nathaniel, was wearing a shirt that said, "Gender-affirming care saves lives." The Clausens' three kids were there, too. Izzy is home from college, Max lives at home while he attends Indiana University, and the youngest is 11-year-old Kieran.
I'm Amy.
Beth.
I'm Nathaniel,
I'm guessing.
This is Emily.
I came to see them because I wanted to talk about an Indiana law banning medical gender-affirming care for minors. The Clausens, along with the ACLU, some other families, and a family practice doctor, sued Indiana over the law when it was passed. The Clausens' daughter, Kieran, was receiving gender-affirming care, and they were worried about what the law would mean for her. And they were angry. They weren't the only ones. In this clip from one of the bill's hearings, you can faintly hear protesters chanting under State Rep. Bradford Barrett's opening remarks.
I would ask people in here to please remain seated, to please limit... I'd like for no signs, banners, or flags. I would like people to please stay seated, and then outbursts of any kind will not be tolerated.
The lawsuit the Clausens brought resulted in an injunction, meaning the law was stopped from going into effect. So at the time of this interview, Kieran was still seeing her healthcare providers in Indiana. But the Clausens knew a ruling could come any day that would force them to seek care out of state. When the bill was first brought, Nathaniel particularly was ready to take action. He knew he was in a privileged position in many ways and felt obligated to take a stand. For one thing, the company he works for supports his advocacy for trans youth. He says in Indiana, that's rare.
I get to speak out, and it's considered one of our caring values. And we really felt like we had to speak up to protect the other families with trans kids that we know about.
The Clausens never expected to be activists or to sue a whole state. Beth admits she really likes when everyone just gets along, and she isn't a fan of change generally. But she and Nathaniel are also devoted parents. Max and Izzy, the older kids, are both cisgender. They're only 18 months apart. And when Izzy and Max were school-aged, Beth and Nathaniel added Kieran to the mix. Max and Izzy said when Kieran was a toddler, she was adorable and loved to be the center of attention. And they were happy to give it. Nathaniel showed me a video of Kieran on his phone. She was 2 years old, wearing a dress-up skirt and dancing. You can hear Izzy laughing in the background.
Hey, Kieran, can you do the hula hula?
Featuring one of the dresses she had stolen from me.
Oh, really? That was yours, the skirt?
It was a dress-up skirt when I was a kid, and then it had been in my room, and as soon as Kieran was old enough to walk, she was like, oh my god, it's pink, and it has a flower on it. And then she stole it.
At two, Kieran dressing in skirts for fun was not an issue for Beth. She thought it was a phase. It was cute and funny. But whether trans, non-binary, or cisgender, many kids have some internal sense of their gender by the time they're 3 years old. And when she was just learning to walk, Kieran often wrapped a towel around her head as if it were long hair and then admired her reflection in the oven door. When she was a little older, Kieran raided Izzy's dress-up clothes and wore them around the house. Eventually, if she wasn't wearing a dress-up outfit, she refused to leave the house. When Beth would try to put boy clothes on Kieran, she would go stiff and not move. A silent but complete boycott. Beth remembers texting her friend, who has a son only 2 years older than Kieran.
When do they get out of this temper tantrum age when they don't want to put their clothes on? And she was like, that never happened with her youngest son. And then I thought about it, I was like, that never really happened with my older two either. Like, this is definitely a new thing.
The conflict sometimes kept them from going out. I asked Beth what that was like for her.
It was a little scary because we started noticing things were a little different. And then she started not being her happy self. She started, withdrawing, and as the tantrums, not tantrums, I hate saying that word because it sounds like she was just being petulant and that's not what it was. The distress of wearing clothing that she didn't feel describe her. And if you're asking me how it made me feel, it made me feel scared. Not because, I am going to cry. It made me feel scared because I didn't want anything to be hard for her. And I kind of was gathering that things would be scary for me and her and hard. And so I was scared. And I think I felt bad for being scared. I remember specifically I was like, it's not that Kieran wants to wear girl clothes. It's that she just wants to be dressed up. So I started buying button down shirts and corduroy pants, so Kieran would look, for lack of a better word, handsome. And then I had a friend say, sorry. Kieran didn't seem like Kieran, like herself, because it was just a day where I put my foot down and I said, we're just going to wear these boy clothes. And they just talked about how Kieran, even at 2.5, or I don't even know how old she was not 3, just like all of the light was out of her. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And then that's when I decided that I can't be scared, and we can't be scared. We just had to do the thing that made my kid be the happy kid that she was when all I had to do was let her wear a dress.
Izzy shifted in her seat and raised her hand.
I think that my parents aren't giving themselves enough credit with the amount of research and time they spent looking into it. Because it wasn't them just going, oh, we're going to stick you in these clothes. It was, we can't find a reason for this. It's new and we don't know what it is.
The watershed moment where we realized that we had to do something was Kieran got out of the bathtub and was running around the house and grabbed a pair of scissors and said, can I cut my penis off? I don't like it very much. And I mean, comically, I don't think any boy has ever wanted to cut their penis off. And so we realized right then that she wasn't a boy. And it was at that point that we let her transition
socially.
And what did that look like? What did that mean for you?
So we went to a local shoe store and we bought her some Elsa and Anna shoes, and they were silver and blue. And she was so excited, she slept in them.
After that, they let Kieran shop in the girls' section at stores.
Seeing her smile and seeing her excitement was so powerful because, as Beth said, she had started to get a little depressed. And we said, okay, if she changes her mind later in life, she'll at least know we love her and listen to her.
After Beth and Nathaniel Claussen started to support their trans feminine daughter Kieran's social transition, they informed their friends and family first. They told me everybody was pretty accepting and willing to learn, but helping Kieran come out as trans was a process. And pretty soon after they bought the Frozen shoes, Kieran got sick, so Beth took her to a clinic to get checked out. She stumbled over Kieran's pronouns during the visit, and the nurse noticed.
And she called me afterwards and just was like, I noticed that you were struggling with how to talk about Kieran. And she's like, would you and Kieran like to talk with someone about Kieran's gender? And so I said, absolutely. I didn't know where in Bloomington to find that. And it's always meant a lot to me. And I still see her at the grocery store. I don't ever say, remember that time? But yeah, she took the time out of her own personal time to find my number and call me and reach out with the therapist who she knew would be understanding and affirming. And so we made an appointment with that therapist, and we've seen that therapist off and on ever since.
Kieran's healthcare providers in Bloomington eventually referred her to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis and their gender health program. There, Kieran received wraparound, multidisciplinary, collaborative care from pediatricians, psychologists, and social workers. This is in line with best practice, according to health experts. And while having a supportive mental health and medical team is important, affirmation from other adults in the lives of gender-diverse kids is crucial. I asked Kieran what school's been like for her.
School has been great because my school is very acceptive. My preschool was also pretty acceptive, and so was the school that I went to before I transferred.
When it was time for Kieran to start kindergarten, Beth wanted to inform some people at the school that Kieran was trans and would be attending as a girl.
We met with the school social worker. We met with the principal. The social worker had had experience with trans students in the past, so she knew what it meant to, you know, affirm and accept Kieran to school.
The social worker worked with the teachers. She made sure that people understood it was okay for Kieran to share her information if she wanted to. It wasn't a secret, but it was for Kieran and the Claussens to share, not anyone else.
So really, we were set up from the beginning for success.
The American Academy of Pediatrics says the decision of whether and when to start gender affirmative treatment is personal and must consider that each patient and family is unique. They say caring for transgender youth ideally happens on an ongoing basis with the entire care team. There is no prescribed path, sequence, or endpoint to this care, but they recognize the positive impact of affirming treatment and care on gender diverse kids who suffer disproportionately from drug use problems, STIs, and suicidal ideation and attempts. According to the latest data on transgender youth from the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, just over 1 in 3 trans respondents attempted suicide in the year prior.
Knock, knock. Hi. Hello.
How are you? I'm good. Just up the road from the Claussens, Dr. Maisha Price is studying LGBTQ+ youth, specifically resilience. When I met them at their office at Indiana University, they were just settling in after moving here from California. The office was completely bare.
I literally brought supplies here today.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm...
I feel like I'm accosting you, like, before you can even get, like,
settled. No, it's fine. It's good.
Dr. Price is an associate professor in the Human Development Program at IU as part of the Counseling and Ed Psych Department. And she's also an associate research scientist at the Kinsey Institute.
I share this because it informs the work that I do, but I am Black, queer, and I'm also a solo parent to a 5-year-old who was assigned male at birth, but enjoys wearing skirts, tutus, and has specifically asked me for a Barbie dream house with a slide, to be exact. And is currently navigating which bathroom to use at school. So that's exciting.
Dr. Price confirms LGBTQ plus youth experience poor mental health and suicidality disproportionately. And she's careful to point out the reason why.
So I think a lot of people get a little bit mixed up because they feel as though, well, it's because your queer identity that you're suffering. And ultimately, there's a middle person in there, and that's the way that they're treated. So one of the things we know and that we see over and over again is that it's the discrimination, the stigma, the bullying, the physical harm, the rejection that they're getting that is then causing these poor mental health outcomes that they see. It's internalizing also the negative things that are happening in society. And so now you feel as though you're a bad person because of the identity that you have.
Dr. Price says the impact of bans on gender-affirming medical care, like Indiana's new law, have a sort of underbelly.
The ban itself isn't really impacting that many young people. And I think people would be surprised to hear me say that. But I think there's this assumption that there's like millions of trans young people who are flocking to medical facilities to get gender affirming care. And I want to back up and talk about what it even is.
Dr. Price says all gender diverse kids benefit from the social aspects of affirming their gender. Things like using preferred pronouns, chosen names, and affirming their use of the bathroom that aligns with their gender. But everybody's different. She says many gender diverse youth aren't seeking treatment like puberty blockers or hormone replacement in order to affirm their identities. And they might never choose to do that. But the legislation banning care is still harmful to them.
So what we're doing effectively is sending a message to millions of young people, even those who are not ever even interested in getting this care, that they are not worthy of being affirmed. Like, we're essentially saying what we're going to do is pass a law that says your value in our society is lesser than other people's. And so that's one of the conversations we're not having about this is the mental health impact of not only the passing of these bills, but the debate, the very debate of them that's happening.
Beth and Nathaniel decided not to allow Kieran to speak during the law's hearings. The hearings were contentious and they wanted to protect her. I asked Kieran if she'd like to share what she would have said if given the chance, and she did.
I may be a small child, but if you make me mad, I'll make sure your eardrums burst with my screams.
On top of experiencing the discrimination of anti-trans laws, some gender-diverse adolescents suffer when they get closer to puberty that doesn't align with their gender identity. Some kids experience increased isolation and depression. They may have problems with their relationships or academics. In Kieran's case, Beth, Nathaniel, and Kieran's entire care team noticed she was having problems the closer she got to puberty. Kieran's doctor has checked her quarterly for the physical and hormonal changes of puberty. Once puberty starts, an endocrinologist can prescribe puberty blockers, which simply stop it until the kid is ready to think about how to proceed with their development. Depending on the person and the care team, a teen may then eventually receive hormones that match the puberty of their gender identity, estrogen for trans feminine teens and testosterone for trans masculine teens. The hormones are the same that are used for cisgender kids who are experiencing early or precocious puberty. Children and adolescents have used these medications since the 1980s. The hormones are reversible, though there is some data to show that prolonged use poses an increased risk for bone loss in trans feminine kids who receive them. In April 2023, Kieran's doctor placed a puberty-blocking hormone implant in her arm. It's a slow-release device, sort of like a contraceptive implant. It stopped her testosterone-rich puberty so that she would have time to consider receiving estrogen later on.
It didn't hurt, but the numbing shot did hurt, and I turned my mom's hand blue.
Squeezing it.
Yeah.
Kieran says she hasn't loved the visits to her doctor because of the puberty checks.
But it's mandatory, and it's making sure that I don't want to go ka-splat off a building. So, yay.
What do you mean when you say you don't want to go ka-splat off a building?
No comment.
Okay, because I think that what you're talking about is suicide. Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't want to say the word because it is a sensitive topic for some people.
It is. You're right. And we're going to be really careful about the way that we talk about it.
The mental health fallout of Kieran not receiving care has worried Nathaniel. His brother died by suicide in 2022.
Puberty sucks for everybody, but to go through a puberty that doesn't align with who you know yourself to be, I don't want my kid taking her life because she has to go through a testosterone-rich puberty.
At the time of this interview, the Claussens were waiting to find out whether Indiana's ban on gender-affirming treatment would go into effect, forcing them to travel out of state for Kieran's care. They were on edge. But here's the thing. What happens to trans kids in conservative states does not rest solely with legislators. Dr. Price says there are things that everyone in every community can do to support them. Things like what Beth's friend did in pointing out Kieran's distress, or what Kieran's nurse practitioner did, what Kieran's school administrators and teachers did. Even Nathaniel's employer supporting his advocacy work is empowering.
What does the literature tell us about proven prevention or protective measures for suicidality among LGBTQ youth? I mean, that's a big question.
Broadly speaking, the protective measures are supportive people, supportive environments. I would say, generally speaking, that's letting people, young people, be who they want to be. And I know that we can do that. We can do that when it comes to music. Well, most of us can do that. When it comes to music, sports, like, we can do that. We can. We can do that when it comes to gender identity and sexual orientation. Like, I promise we can. So let's just bring all that in, right? Like, teachers, coaches, all these people that young people spend time around, if they're affirming and supportive, like, it can literally save lives.
Having safe, supportive schools is a moral imperative.
It is illegal to not be at school. So if we're going to force them to be there, we have to make it safe for them to be there. That's just baseline. So what does affirming schools look like? And again, there's a lot of different ways, but we can think about gender neutral bathrooms. We could talk about making sure that young people have the option of using their chosen name, pronouns, and things like that are so important. Specifically addressing sexual orientation and gender identity in your bullying policies and being strict about them, not just saying it and moving on. Training staff, all these things are so important when we're talking about how to create a safe environment for young people.
And this includes family functions.
If you're thinking about holidays, you're thinking about things like that, like, would you take your child or the young person in your life to a situation where someone's going to hit them in the head with a bat? No. You would not expose them to something physically harmful, so you shouldn't do it if it's going to be mentally harmful.
A few months after our first visit, I called the Claussens via video chat. Nathaniel and Beth sat down in front of the camera while Kieran danced in a gold skirt in the background.
Kieran, you look amazing today. I really like that top.
Thanks.
It's really cute. You look very cute.
Back in February, Nathaniel was driving home from work one evening, and he was just passing the Kroger in Bloomington when a lawyer from the ACLU called him.
I pulled over and they were shaken up. And in listening to them, it shook me up a little bit as well.
The hammer had fallen. The injunction was stayed. The ban was immediately in effect. The law didn't disrupt Kieran's medical care as much as some other kids, because her puberty-blocking hormones were administered by an implant. But many adolescents get puberty-blocking hormones as shots.
So, you know, like, families went to bed and they woke up in the morning and their prescriptions couldn't be filled. Or they had doctor's appointments the next day and the doctor's offices had to call and say, you can't come in. Or if you come in, we can't discuss gender-affirming care because this law went in place.
And you know this because you were talking with other families?
Yes. Like,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Claussens have decided to go to Boston for Kieran's care. It's not the closest place to get care. Chicago is. But they chose Boston in part because they thought the clinics there might not be as crowded as Chicago, a place that's now a hub for folks from surrounding states with bans.
the law bans gender-affirming care for minors, but it also states that physicians cannot refer their clients out to other providers. So, like, how are people getting this information and resources outside of from their care providers, their physicians? Do you know?
Yes. A lot of it is word of mouth. Parents reaching out to other parents. There's organizations like Gender Nexus, Protect Our People, Gecko. Another group would be Trans Solutions. They're located in Indianapolis.
Okay. For more information about the organizations connecting people to care and a national resource map, go to our website, radioproject.org, where you can find links in the show notes. Beth and Nathaniel have continued their advocacy work. They say it helps them feel less powerless to help others. The organization Beth helped start, Protect Our People, has been connecting Hoosiers to gender-affirming care outside the state.
We actually were able to help two people this past week get the care that they needed.
She says donations to Protect Our People have increased too.
But I would say the greater population doesn't have any idea what's going on still. Families with trans kids and the trans community in general are kind of are living an alternative reality. You know, Kieran still asks us questions like, wait a minute, I can still get my diabetes care, right? Like we have to remind her or reassure her that it's just this one kind of care.
Kieran, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Would you feel comfortable sharing like how you're feeling right now?
About what?
Just with the changes, now that everything's gone into that the ban has gone into effect in February, like, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I don't really care. I'm used to this. I'm used to being hated on.
That sounds hard. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think she doesn't want to talk about it. She doesn't want to hear about it. Like, she's done.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Now the Clausens are turning toward each other and toward Joy. I asked them, besides this law, what's new?
We spontaneously got a new puppy a couple of weeks ago. It was the most impulsive puppy adoption ever.
Impulsive puppy adoption.
And it was totally worth it.
I asked Beth how our listeners could get involved.
Talking to their legislators. They don't have to understand what it means to be transgender or to have a transgender child, but they need to talk to their legislators about how wrong it is for them to be making decisions for people's children. There's doctors for that reason. They are not doctors.
She says another thing anyone can do is support organizations that help trans kids and also speaking up.
And telling people that we are all on the same side. We all love our kids and we all want what's best for them. If we could just get that message across.
Great. Is there anything else you think I should know?
Kieran would like to show you the puppy, if that's okay.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Show me the puppy. Oh, she's huge. Oh my gosh.
She's not very cuddly right now.
Yeah, but we named her Socks.
What?
Because her front two paws.
I get it. Very cute. I'm Amy Gastelum. If you or someone you know needs confidential support with suicide prevention, call the free 24/7 national hotline 988.
Hi, this is Marcy Winograd. Code Pink Radio returns to the KPFK airwaves Friday at 6 a.m. starting January 16th, 2026.
Go Pink for freedom. Go Pink for peace. Go Pink to hunger and war have ceased.
Code Pink Radio is a weekly anti-war radio show produced by Code Pink, a women-led grassroots peace organization focused on ending U.S. wars, building a peace economy, and promoting human rights. Code Pink Radio features global grassroots activists discussing and offering practical steps for activism and inspiring stories of peace and resistance. That's Code Pink Radio Fridays at 6 a.m. starting January 16th, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Together we'll make peace.
They say code war.
We say code pink.
Many listeners make KPFK possible by giving what they can. Some donate monthly, others give once a year, and some give in a big way by donating land or real estate that they no longer need. That unused cabin, a vacant lot, or a home that's no longer in use, those properties can help ensure a future for your community radio station. Real estate donations can come with tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora, and its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine. I'm your guest host, Charlotte Landis, and you're listening to Making Contact.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer. I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. But... It is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is, it's got to be somewhere else when I write or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because of course the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely
look into my past.
Nnedi Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to my siblings and I back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they are manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And they are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia and cloth that they can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, which is, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. So, and they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times, we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerades show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way where they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So yes, I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 and I want to do this to you, and oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, motherfucker, I will kill you if you don't get a fuck with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. So my friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. And so I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed the whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like, you know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing, as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said, We need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there, and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, mm-hmm. allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun,
mm-hmm.
And using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer, where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start.
Right.
And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and what I want to see, the changes that I want to see, and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more a more indirect way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are, because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop. But having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract,
right,
you know,
of
so
course.
People will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this, going from African-Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African-Americans in it? How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To, you know, 25 years later, as my vampire novel is about to have its 25th anniversary, and a new edition, to see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities, poorer communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You're listening to Afrofuturist authors on Making Contact. Nalo Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series and Akata Warrior. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. For more information about these authors, visit the Making Contact website, radioproject.org, where you'll also find past episodes. You can sign up for news about upcoming shows, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. You can also find us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. Please rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out why this monster is so central to so many of my stories. There are two. One of them is Godzilla. And this is why I'm sitting here trying to figure out, okay, because Godzilla has shown up in many of my stories in various ways. And I know that if someone were to just ask me without intellectualizing it, why do I like Godzilla, it's Godzilla's destructive nature. Godzilla comes out of the water and just destroys There's no rhyme or reason. Just comes out, destroys everything, and then goes back into the water. I love that. And I don't know why. I don't know why. There's something about it. And it may have something to do with my obsession with post-apocalyptic narratives as well.
Okay.
This idea of everything being destroyed.
you know, and then having to deal with that. Mm-hmm. It also may have to do with my anger issues. I don't know.
Get it somewhere. All right.
A lot of rage. The second monster, it's not really a monster. It's just this entity that has shown up consistently in my works now. It's in Lagoon, and it's in A Catawitch Part 2 as well. And it's this spider. It's this giant spider that is, its name is Udide, which means spider in Igbo. The first time the idea of the spider showed up in one of my stories, it was in my story called Spider the Artist, which deals with the Niger Delta, where you've got like these, it's set in the near future, where you have these, the government and the oil companies have created these robot spiders to guard the pipelines, the oil pipelines in Nigeria, can prevent people from bunkering. And these spiders, of course, they kill anyone who touches them. They just tear them to shreds so that they can guard the oil. So that's sort of another story. But this spider is not Anansi. I know that. I'm terrified of spiders. I don't know why. It's an irrational fear. And so spiders have always shown up in my stories, but this particular large one, it lives underneath the city of Lagos, and it turns onto its back and feels the vibrations of the people. And it's a monstrous spider, and it weaves and creates stories and narrative and controls everything. It's just... Yeah, so that's my second spider. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Okay, so I want to stop and read that story like right now.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Well, I guess my monster started out as those two guys on the street, and has evolved to any figures that prey upon people who are less, powerful.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing vampire stories, because Dracula is such a pervasive mythology, such a pervasive character, and insidious because he's charming and he's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the original ones, that he, seduces women and kills them. And everybody is like excited. Dracula's coming over. You know, I'm like,
wait, what? Is it?
So that really fascinated me, that people would find this such a romantic figure in such a predatory figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember one day I went with my mother and grandmother to see the play Dracula on Broadway. We left that and went to see the movie with Frank Langella, which was playing in Times Square,
Same time.
And we were in conversation about that for hours. Like, how could he be so sexy and be such a killer?
Right.
That really set me up to work on how to redo the mythology so that I felt like vampire could be heroic and not a predator, not a serial killer. And in this new book that I'm working on, it's about the society becoming predatory, using people who are empathic, using people who have certain kinds of skills, artistic skills, and making them work for the government, segregating them into patches so they only associate with people who are doing what they do. And how to escape that. So the monster is really those who prey on less powerful people.
It is Stagoli, it is Papa Legba, it is Ishu. It is that tall, lean man, dark man in the top hat,
yes,
who knows more about the dark in you than you do, and knows that you want it.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to see, and what I think is going to, we're going to see more and more African writers from the continent,
that's right,
writing Afrofuturist stories. And I think that the change that I've seen, because I've had a lot of interaction with especially Nigerian writers. And what I remember from maybe about 10 years ago, there was this general attitude of what is real literature, and science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction were not considered real literature, and what was considered real literature were like Things Fall Apart, you know, serious writing without any of that weird stuff going on in it. But I think that we'll see more more Africans directly from the continent writing this kind of literature, and I think that what they write is going to have like a different flavor as well. And what I also would like to see in terms of Afrofuturism is just more diversity in the types of writing. I'd like to see female writers, writers with disabilities, just more variety within Afrofuturist writing.
Right.
That's what I'm waiting to see, because right now it's so small. You know, and it's slowly building. It's slowly building, and it's increasing and growing. But I'd like to see more of that, and I'd also like to see really an extremely successful Afrofuturist writer, extremely successful, as in like best-selling status,
yes. Yeah.
Who's mediocre.
Wow!
I want to see that. Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. I want to see that.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. Mm. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org